Sirius XM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick.
Enough!
Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
Sirius 219, XM 201, Sports Zone 964, if you're listening to Sirius XM online and at our website, stevebick.com. And I wish I had a more cheery and enthusiastic opening on a Monday after a Triple Crown event. But that wouldn't be appropriate, and it wouldn't be a response to the kind of Saturday that, in a lot of ways, only racing seems to produce. And I'll be honest that I have grappled here for whatever it is, going on 48 hours for a appropriate, proper way to digest and regurgitate the remarkable and horrible and utterly complex results that and circumstances that unfolded. You had what was already a charged atmosphere. Even without the prequel to Saturday's feature, all the angst and hand-wringing over one Derby horse making it to Baltimore and all the things that go with that, the backdrop of 2 weeks and more leading into Derby and Derby aftermath, and then, as it came to the fore, the return of Bob Baffert to the Triple Crown scene. And even without the tragic breakdown of having a meltdown, Baffert and team's potential win in the Preakness was going to, if that's how it had unfolded, it would have produced a conflicted and vitriolic response. But what transpired in the Chick Lang with having a meltdown going wrong in the left front, it wouldn't matter if it's a Thursday sprint, if it's a Saturday stake, anywhere else. And in a lot of ways, people I think that have spent periods of time investing their emotion in the game, and not just their emotion, but in many, many cases, obviously, stakeholders and horse players and people that work in any capacity around the game. You absorb those tragedies and understand, how difficult it is, how it doesn't get, pushed aside, but that everyone has, in the case of those working, they've got a job to do, and everyone pushes on. And, obviously the pronounced aspect of this, of, it being a horse, having a meltdown, being a horse that Bob Baffert trains, just added this dizzying layer of just torment and difficulty to taking it in and having to respond to it. You're not a human being if after that moment, the rest of the day isn't sober and deflated. There's simple reactions on I guess in any direction of just being immune to it and just going on and not letting it affect you or not having to make a decision about your commitment to the game. And then on the other side, you could go looking for a villain and those that are those that are in that camp, they've got a ready villain in Bob Baffert. And somewhere in between is probably the realities. I thought that Tim Layden's piece for NBC Sports had the most complete view, calling it a Dickensian scenario. In the shadow of tragedy, Baffert wins national treasure and return to Preakness stage. I sent it out for those that hadn't seen it yet. I would love to call Tim and have him do a better job than I'm doing, responding to everything that transpired. His hearing issue that he's been grappling with for a few years now, it continues to to be an issue, and so we can't. I know that he told me at Churchill he can't even wear like headphones to have an interview scenario. So we'll have to rely, as Tim, he's gone through some surgeries and it's a very, speaking of complex, it's a very complex thing that he's dealing with, and apparently a family, I don't call it a trait, but something that the family has dealt with, early hearing loss and issues. But luckily you've got Tim Layden's written word to help you grapple with something like this and with what transpired, because I think if you listen to this show for any period of time, that my inclination is always to be positive, and I'm not going to be positive. But this aside from the loss of a equine athlete, and luckily Louis Saez able to escape injury, temporarily for some and perhaps permanently for others, Saturday's result takes a lot of the enjoyment and what we look to the game for. And that, I think, that's to me a bigger concern and takeaway than the mainstream media attacks and the characterization of sharks in the water and whatever else you want to however else you want to characterize the response to this. It just drains everything out of everything that you like about the game is threatened under those circumstances. And I know that because of who was involved in terms of Bob Baffert, it's more pronounced. But those of us that were there at Belmont when Mr. Nickerson and Shaker Knit died in the sprint, and then of course Gopher Wand, you know what it's like to be at a big day. I mean you can go back to Derby to some degree. This was more Gopher Wand-esque in a lot of ways. I can go on and associate things and try to better verbalize feelings, but they're everybody's going to have their own. My dictating to anybody or trying to assuage the hurt or the anger, I think if I was able to do that, I'd have had a more prepared response. I had to come on the network at 7:20, literally within 15 minutes, and Tom Byrne asked me, my reaction, it's funny. I let my reaction kind of spill out because I really hadn't had time to think about things and or to take in other, other responses and. Use them to help knit my own reaction. And I just said that this is going to be a result that is going to be incredibly polarizing and you know, in terms of the Preakness result. And obviously it has been. So we'll do this over the next 2 hours and 45 minutes. We'll get a couple of, probably, you know, more thoughtful reaction from two people. Top of next hour, Nick Luck will join us. And Nick had to do a little of everything, I guess, on that, from what I could tell, on that broadcast on Saturday. And Nick and I have talked about, you know, challenges here and abroad a few times over the years, whether it's in the context of the Grand National and other high-profile events. And Nick has got a very clear-eyed approach. So look forward to letting Nick help provide some clarity. And Steve Crist, who, you know, really has got the horizon view, specifically in you know, terms of these shores. So Steve Crist at 11, Nick Luck at 10. And then, of course, we've got some of the winning connections, and we'll do that for a few days. Today and tomorrow are always a little tricky because of the sale, and they'll start in less than 2 hours now at Timonium. We still got now two more sales yet. We've got the June OBS 2-year-old sale, and then of course Phasic's got one more. They've got a new June sale of their own, but Timonium should be a good couple of days, and a lot of people obviously that come in for Preakness, they stay around. Yesterday to, you know, they first they go to the Bree show, and then they follow up with the barn views and shortlisting and the like, and we'll get 2 days of horse sale there at Timonium today. So and there'll be a couple of people that are on the grounds, including Dan Blacker in hour two. And as we, you know, try to, you know, get excited at least and appreciate what it meant Friday and Saturday for winning connections, Straight No Chaser looks like a absolute sprint monster. And first opportunity to mention a jockey ahead of others that were successful over the weekend, obviously for John Velasquez, who was aboard Straight No Chaser, a very good afternoon that was capped with his first Preakness win. 2 weeks ago, it was Javier Castellano, his first Derby, and now Johnny gets his first Preakness. And in terms of straight performance evaluation and race evaluation, to take a second before I tell you who else is joining us, the race itself unfolded, I think, how we all expected, and in fact there was even, you know, less of a pace challenge to National Treasure. And I mean, the pace at which the race unfolded, it was going to get pretty clear when Mage, you know, who, you know, seemingly was traveling well, when he ranged up and it looked like, you know, off the turn he might collar the leaders, and, you know, basically seemingly leveled off. He actually came home okay. But National Treasure and Blazing Sevens were not coming back. and the two of them down the lane in, I mean, if you distill this to the pure essence that the game ideally offers, two horses, two riders, it was a fabulous stretch duel. And, of course, I'm sure there'll be a discussion. Rich Migliori will join us in hour three today. Actually, we'll push Rich back a little bit to accommodate Nick Luck. But obviously a real question whether Blazing Sevens would have survived an inquiry had he gotten down over National Treasure, because Arad Ortiz just can't help himself, it seems. Chad's been polite about it, but I seemed a little nonplussed about how Arad chose to, what the paths he chose to take. And on that topic, I mean, Chad's got this move. he's got this skip the Derby, hit the Preakness. He's got this down pat. There's no matter what the horse looks like. Not that everyone that he's brought like this has converted, but Blazing Sevens ran a winning race and stepped up. National Treasure has basically been running similar races and. Getting to the front, he had been kind of in chase stalk mode in his most recent, and whether with Baffert or with the Yak team. So the blinkers helped, and what helped the most was that there just wasn't pace pressure. There wasn't any, or nearly enough. Coffee with Chris tried for a way, and then it fell to Blazing Sevens. Nobody else was really available. Obviously, this race, who knows how different this is with First Mission. But yeah, you'd have to think that First Mission, based on his style, would have been a big presence here and changes the race dynamics considerably. And this is one reason why it's hard to understand why more horses didn't step to the fore. But as stretch duels go in big races, might not have been Sunday Silence an easy goer, but it was pretty good. So big weekend for Johnny and Dan Blacker with obviously a horse in Straight No Chaser who came back with a 107 buyer. And this is clearly a spitester. Speaking of prematurely departed stallions, poor spitester who's gotten his share. I mean, he feels like he was on his way to being like Spitestown or Munnings. But Straight No Chaser, happy for Dan Blacker. We're going to talk to Randy Morse here momentarily, and I'll try to lift the mood and lift the discourse into a more excited mode. And I as I wrote on Saturday when I posted the Preakness card selections and analysis, as it were, and opinions, having Taxed run the way she did was about as satisfying an outcome as you can have, when you do this. And I mean, those of you that listened for weeks leading into Oaks, how much we wanted to get her into the Oaks, instead, Randy Morse shrugged it off, went forward, and she could not have been better winning the Black Eyed Susan, and a huge win. $50,000 claim. That's another exciting and positive portion of this. So Randy Morse, he's going to join us next. Johnny V, by the way, is going to join us at 10:40. Looking forward to that. And so much more. All right, let me get Randy Morse in here, because that this will be obviously a very happy conversation. And it, frankly, Randy Morse winning this race and Rafi Bejerano. What about for Rafi? How great this is. Whose career has taken some dips and turns. Randy Morse, though, joining us now to celebrate Friday's win in the Black Eyed Susan. Randy, congratulations. Well done.
Thank you very much.
This one, I'm, you're going to hear the laughter in my voice, and you know I was saying that if you drew into the Oaks 2 weeks ago, I said you were going to be the Rich Strike of 23 in the Oaks, because she looked so good preparing for Churchill, and then fires that 59 bullet after the Oaks preparing for this. You got to be so delighted with the way this has all turned out.
Yeah, it was, it's really nice. You know, obviously I would have loved to have been in the Oaks, but that's something that was out of our control. But, I mean, this is not no bad alternative.
Exactly. We got a few things to figure out here and talk about, but I think the first order of business is claiming this filly. And you know, talk a little bit about you know, the tracking and identifying her as a candidate and how all that started.
You know, I'd seen her train. I watch a lot of horses and train, you know, that even the ones that aren't mine, just to, you know, like once I see them, I kind of recognize them for the most part. And she had always trained really good in the mornings. And then I thought her race at Keeneland, you know, when she, the time before I claimed her, she looked like she was going to win then. And that track was really loose and cuppy that day. And she got a little tired there late. Then when they put her in for the 50, I thought, you know, it might be a good time to try her. And luckily, and we won, you know, it was a shake when we won the shake to get her also. So a lot of luck involved.
How many were in the shake?
I think three, maybe four. I'm thinking three, but I'm not so sure. You know, nowadays, every time you go to claim a horse, it's umpteen way shake.
Yeah.
They pretty much dummy-proof the claiming game because of this. If they come back a little bit off, they take them back and all that stuff, so, which I'm totally against, but that's the rules.
Well, I'm sure, you know, as the story goes forward and as her, you know, career continues to unfold, it'll turn out that there'll be at least 15 or 18 people that'll say they put in for her.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's usually the way it is, you know. You know how the racetrack is.
You know, just like all the underbidders on stake horses. Ah, you know, I was the underbidder.
That's for sure, yeah. I'm actually at the sale right now in Maryland.
Nice.
Looking at horses. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny because there's nothing like winning, you know, during Preakness weekend to, you know, galvanize your clients.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, any win's good. I've said that before. I don't care if it's a maiden claimer. A win's a win. So.
Well, in this case, you know, you take this horse and pretty quickly, I mean, how did it unfold from there in terms of, you know, you were at Oaklawn with her over the winter and you tried her in the year's end, going the mile, then she, you know, seemed to take a nice step forward in the Martha Washington, you know, the Honeybee, you know, it was a lot of wet track issues at Oaklawn over the winter. You know, I've heard plenty of people say that, you know, they couldn't really train as much as and as hard as they would have liked. I mean, talk about the winter and then, you know, the fantasy and everything that transpired between then and now.
Well, in Honeybee, when she had the 12 post, she lost all chance. You know, you can't win there. Out of that post, going long, and she hit pretty good in that race. Hit herself behind because of the sloppy track. But and that, you know, I think that day if she would have drawn in, had a better post, she would have probably got enough points that she would have been able to be in the Oaks. But the key with her was when we took the blinkers off. I mean, it just made a totally different horse out of her because she was always willing, but she was a little too willing. You know, and when we took the blinkers off, she just relaxed. And as you seen the other day, I mean, he tucked her in behind horses and she was nice and relaxed. And when he called on her, she was there for him.
Well, and even I think the first evidence that you got was that nice forward move she took in the Fantasy, where, you know, she wet paint obviously comes running, and you know she got passed by, you know, by wet paint, but she also had a big fig jump there into the mid 80s on the buyer scale, and you could see on the sheets that, you know, she was also, you know, poised and seemed ready for the next step. I've obviously talked about it on air, and I talked, you know, sent you notes, you know, texts. She trained Randy as well as any filly not named Pretty Mischievous, and I mean, if she had gotten in, she was the pick for me at the Oaks.
Yeah. You know, in the Fantasy, if you really watch the race, she was in behind horses, and he really couldn't get out until late. I mean, when he'd come back, he says, I don't know if we would have won, but he said, if I could have gotten out clear to run when I wanted, it was going to be a lot closer. And then her gallop out in the Fantasy was, I thought, was great, you know.
Hmm.
So, but yeah, she's really turned a corner. She's growed up, you know, and matured, and she's a pretty nice filly.
Well, the performance on Friday, talk a little bit about, you know, the approach, what you and Raffy talked about. We should also include Richard Batty as well, and talk about him as a client and what this means to him.
Oh, he was just ecstatic, you know. I've had horses for him for several years now. Mainly we claim, and you know, great guy. I mean, well deserving. He was just, you know, he just couldn't hardly believe it after it happened. But it's funny. It was probably a week after we had claimed her. He called me. He said, "Well, what do you think?" I says, "I can tell you this, Dick. She's not just an average horse. She goes better than just your everyday horse. Now, whether she'll turn out to be, that remains to be seen. But, you know, she just had that way of training and moving. She's a little different horse than your average horse."
Well, and you know, he's had some success too. He had that nice Pinson, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
He's had good horses. He's been very successful in the game.
Yeah, yeah. For, you know, what we've for not spending, compared to these guys nowadays. Yeah, absolutely. Pinson was a good horse for us, and we also had a horse named Cougar Ridge that did really well. So
that was
I
remember that horse too. That Cougar Ridge.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Well,
yeah, he won the, I think it was a Delta Mile.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
Mm-hmm.
A Delta, that's terrific, a Delta Downs. Was he a horse that was claimed?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
How
we
about
claimed
that?
Him also.
How about that, Randy? Unbelievable. Well, you go into this spot, and, you know pricing-wise, the felt like the odds were right, you know, for her. And, you know, she took a little money, but basically was where, you know, we expected price-wise. What were the thoughts going in, and how did, you know, how did you and Raffy set things up? What was the game plan?
Pretty much the way it turned out. It looked like there was some inside speed, and, you know, she's got enough speed to be you know, I knew she wouldn't, if she broke well, she wouldn't be too far back. And I mean, I thought he rode her perfect. And then when they headed up the backside, when she was, you know, anytime you're in behind the speed and you're right there behind them and you're clear with nobody on the outside of you, that's where you want to be. So if you got horse, that's usually, you can make something happen.
Well, and the way, you know, the way he basically was just moving at will and staying in touch, keeping tabs on Hoosier Philly, who ran a dynamite snapback race for Tom Amos Gold Standard. But when called upon there mid-stretch, I mean, she came storming down the center.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, last fall, Hoosier Philly, I mean, I thought she might have been as good as we've seen in a long, long time. She was really special as a two-year-old. So if you'd ever told me that this filly would be able to beat her back in the fall, it'd be like, no, you're crazy, you know?
Well,
so, yeah, it's really, she's really changed, so.
When Rafi, you know, drew even and you know, they weren't together the way the Preakness pair was, but you know, just a steady advance, ends up winning by almost four lengths on the chart, pays $24, and obviously a pretty joyous group. And the best line was from you saying that you wish you had bet a little more.
Yeah, well, actually, I think if they wouldn't have scratched them two Pletcher horses, we'd have probably got a 4 or 5 points higher.
I don't disagree. Unbelievable. As it settles in, what kind of a summer do you think for her looking ahead?
I mean, you know, I don't know. We'd obviously like to try to win a grade one with her if possible,
sure.
But I mean, we'll see. You know, we'll just see how she comes back. And
grade one opportunities, this is obviously great too, but the grade one opportunities include a race like the Alabama. And, you know, what's interesting about her pedigree-wise, and this is a Governor Jones Airdrie product, a collected out of a Yankee gentleman mare. And it sure looks like, you know, even something like the Alabama is would suit her.
Yeah, she don't. I mean, Bray Arano, when he come back the other day, he said this filly will run all day. So, you know, and to look at her, you wouldn't think she's not a big, long, rangy made filly, you know, like most of them that want to go that far. But she seems to get it done. So, lucky us.
Well, luck, I'll pull out Branch Rickey and say luck is the residue of design. And you designed this one absolutely just perfectly, from a $50,000 claim to graded stake place, now graded stake winner. And Randy, you must be tickled. I know you're not big out there on social media, but you got to be tickled by the reaction. I mean, so many people and you know, real racetrack people just delighted for you to have this kind of a success.
Yeah. That's, I think I had like 250 texts afterwards. It was crazy, but yeah.
Well,
you know, to be respected by your peers, that means a lot to me.
Well, that you are, and you've been doing it a good long while, approaching 1,100 career wins. And you know, doing it this way, and you know, not that you don't buy young horses and develop them too, but turning a claim like this into a graded stake winner, and obviously a horse with more upside yet, and you know, she's a collected, you know, the future looks bright. I mean, collected is gonna, you know, a horse like that could just keep getting better as she gets older.
Yeah, yeah, and knock on wood, she's very sound. So, yeah, it looks future looks bright.
I love it. Well, Randy, I wanted to start the conversations this morning with you after a pretty unusual weekend, but certainly on Friday, everybody left there in good spirits. And you know, your string mostly at Churchill, but you got some at Prairie too, I see.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, biggest part of them are Churchill, and then there's a handful at Prairie Menace.
Well, we're looking forward to following Taxed and wherever she's showing up next. And obviously, a lot of good things ahead. Randy Morse, well done. Congratulations. Talk soon.
Thank you very much.
Good luck at the sale, too.
I appreciate that.
Not at all. Randy Morse, everybody. And one of the things that really, if you hadn't seen the comments and you know, the reaction to Randy Morse winning this, it says a lot about him. I'm looking forward to talking to Sid, too, on Wednesday about her you know, collected out of a Yankee gentleman mare. And you don't have to worry about buying horses that have the Brereton Jones touch on them. His broodmare band and what he and now son Brett have crafted at Airdrie. The results have been speaking for themselves for a long time. And this is it's encouraging for any kind of an operation. $50,000 claim. And she's, who knows where she goes. We're going to go to Graham Motion next. And it's Graham's birthday. Don't tell anybody. Graham Motion's going to join us. And Nagarok, if we're talking three-year-olds, Nagarok's win with authority. And speaking of authority, how about Flavian Pratt and what he put together over the 2 days? Five stake wins? Yeah, he won with Rattle and Roll from McPeak. Haven't even mentioned the Pimlico Special, which was an absolute thriller. Rattle and Roll, Connect veteran, and Pratt aboard there. He was on Asprey, the Hilltop winner, the three-year-old filly race, on Friday for Chad. And that was the other Quality Road that won over the weekend, because, of course, National Treasure, Quality Road. But then on Saturday, Never Explain, Shug. I get a lot of people were surprised. I had him as sort of a, you know, exotic candidate, but I didn't think Never Explain was completely impossible. But Never Explain in the dinner party with Pratt. Beer Can Man, and got to get to Phil D'Amato in the next day or two, because D'Amato's a handful. Just unbelievable. He won yesterday too, right? He won he won both the stakes at Santa Anita over the weekend. He won that Misdirection with Elm Drive, yeah, on Saturday, and then came back yesterday, wins the Desert Code. But Pratt on Beer Can Man. And there was one more, right? Nagarok. Yeah, there it is. There's five. So let's get to Graham. I don't want to get too far off a field. And I don't know if Graham might be at the sale. As I've said, I mean, the Monday and Tuesday after Preakness weekend is always, it's always tough. The sale actually doesn't start till 11 o'clock. Graham Motion, first and foremost, obviously, happy birthday.
Thank you, Steve. How did you know?
How did I know? This internet, I mean, it's ridiculous.
I know. It's a little shocking.
That everybody, how many birthday greetings so far? And it's only 9:45.
Yeah, it's very nice. It's very kind of people.
Well, you know what I'll do? I'll put up that great picture I have of you as a teenager. That's my favorite.
I only have 1 year left in my 50s, which is a little shocking.
That is, that, frankly, it's shocking. With as many wins as you've piled up, it's shocking that you haven't crossed that barrier yet.
I know, it's shocking and disturbing.
thank you for that segue, by the way, Graham. Let's do the happy news first and talk about Nagarok's win, because
I think I should only have to do happy news on my birthday.
You're not going to get away with that, I'm afraid. You might be able to, because I know that you're upbeat about today, the kickoff, obviously, of the Haiwu and the ADMC portion of ISA. We'll talk about that as part of today's conversations. Steve Crist later, too, and Nick Luck. But, Graham, talk about Nagarok first, because this race, you kind of felt, you look at those three-year-old turfers, there's upside for a lot of them, and then he just handled them. Without even a whip and a chair.
Yeah, I mean, look, a couple of people, I ran a lot of horses on Saturday. A couple of people had asked me what my best chance was. I really thought he was my best chance. We were pretty adamant that the blinkers were going to help him. Flavian had suggested it kind of last time he rode him at Kingland. And then Emma Carey, who gets on him every morning, she brought it up independently in the morning. With his breezes. So I think between the two of them, it was a no-brainer to give it a try, and this was a great opportunity to do it. And I think it really did turn him around, even though he was a short favorite and obviously expected to win the race.
This is a horse that has not run a bad race yet, and you have trotted him, you know, all over the place, to be honest, including out to California for the Eddie Logan at the end of the year, after he had been a good third in the juvenile turf. He won the Futurity going back to early in the two-year-old year off the maiden. I mean, he's never been worse than third in eight starts. So, I mean, he fires. Talk about the way this unfolded and you know how you lay out. I mean, the three-year-old campaigns are pretty easy for these kinds of horses.
Yeah, I mean, look, we threw a lot at this horse. John Panagot found him in Indiana off of a second place finish in a maiden race, an unlucky second. We took him straight to Aqueduct a month later, which is not something I would normally do, getting a new horse, but we, you know, when the Breeders' Cup's around the corner, you have to find things out with these horses. So he responded well to his maiden race. He came right back when we put him in a stake race, impressively, off a quick turnaround. And I thought his Breeders' Cup run was it was phenomenal. I mean, first time going two turns against those kind of horses. So probably the one glitch was me getting carried away and sending him out to California in December rather than giving him, you know, the time off to freshen up. I just felt like he was doing so well. He didn't necessarily need a break at that time. But after the Eddie Logan, we gave him, you know, we spaced his races out, gave him about a month of not doing much in Florida. And I thought his run in the Transylvania was very good. I mean, he really hasn't done much wrong, this horse.
No. Where do you rank and what do you look for going forward with him?
I talked a little bit with the guys about possibly the Manila at Belmont. That would set him up for the summer races. I think the mile is really appealing. I think that's probably what he wants to do. I mean, I don't know if you saw him Saturday, but he's a really flashy, big, strong horse with a great head on his shoulders. He's pretty exciting. He really is.
Well, I'm just thumbing through. There it is. Part of a fabulous weekend, by the way, for those that there were some far-flung successes for Little Red Feather over the weekend, and this is one.
Yeah,
that,
great day, great weekend, right? For those guys, and they're great fun to work with. You know, Billy really gets it, and it's a pleasure working for those guys. I feel lucky to be part of it.
Well, this one is a Lee colt, and. Also partnered in is Sol Kumin's Matticat people and Bill Strauss. Always valuable when looking for that Pamplemousse reservation at Del Mar.
Absolutely. I mean, he also knows a lot of other extremely nice restaurants in the area. So he's a good one to be in. Bill's great. I mean, this is kind of a new partnership with us, and obviously Sol's been a great supporter of mine. So I'm extremely fortunate to have these guys.
And yeah, I was going to ask you about distance. I mean, you're going to keep it focused on the mile?
He's quick. You know, I like the mile for him. I really do. I'm not saying he won't go further, but I think right now that's what we should focus on.
All right. Well, Nagarok, the big stake win, but you had plenty of other activity, Graham, and that included the pair in the dinner party and Hurricane Dream and Speaking Scout, and both had looks. I forgot you had Easter in there too, actually. I'm just looking down at the chart. There was Bipartisanship and Vergara in the Gallarette, as well as Soprin Basilia, who ran well to be second. And then you had the allowance win with Amani's Image, as well as a girl from Ireland, who I thought had a price look and ran well. That feels like she's on the upswing.
Yeah, I was surprised. I mean, she was morning line, I think, 15-1.
Yeah.
She went off at 5-1, which was, I even remember commenting to my wife before the race. But I thought she ran super. Georgie had to move a little earlier than he wanted to in that race. Johnny was able to come through and win the race for us, which was tremendous for some new clients. You know, we ran a lot of horses this weekend, so it was great to have a couple of winners on the day. Obviously, it was important, even though I thought a lot of the horses ran really well in placing.
How about this this Soprin Basilia?
Yeah, I would say that might have been the surprise of the weekend for me, because I just didn't know what to expect. I thought we were running her a little shorter than she wants to go. She was really gutsy. Javier gave her a great ride. He picked up the ride at the last minute, when Louis had to go to hospital. So, but she really was gutsy. I thought she came with a huge run, and obviously Chad's horse stood out by being.
Oh, talk about their share of assignments this summer.
Yeah, I didn't think Hurricane Dream had any excuses, really. I thought he ran super. Joel gave him a great ride. Just couldn't quite get to Shug's horse. I thought the unlucky one was probably Speaking Scout, who just had a wall of horses in front of him. And Georgie just said he really had nowhere to go. He thought, I don't know if he wins, but I think he's right there if he gets through that wall of horses.
In terms of keeping these horses apart, you know, Easter in there too, but yes, he was in the dinner party. But the top pair in Hurricane Dream and Speaking Scout, you know, you're going to keep them apart as the summer unfolds?
Yeah, I'd like to. I mean, look, it wasn't ideal running all three of them in this race, but it's in our backyard, and my owners wanted to take a shot. We skipped Kentucky with Speaking Scout because we thought it was coming back too quickly, and we'd pointed Hurricane Dream for the race for a while. So, yeah, I don't think there's going to be any trouble keeping them apart going forward. There are so many options. And Easter's still eligible for two other than in New York, which I think is where you'll see him next.
Excellent. All right. Well, you did seem, you know, poised for the weekend. But it was funny how all the stakes, just the way the calendar fell, or the way the 2 days were organized, that you had all that stakes activity on Saturday, and just allowance tries on Friday. I thought that Chulain, I was kind of expecting, I thought that Chulain was kind of in the more, you know, most likely catbird seat in that allowance on Friday.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I thought he might have been one of the best. He's one of the ones I was excited about running this weekend. I don't think Pimlico particularly suits him now in hindsight. I think he really likes Belmont. He came running. He galloped out in front. It just was a little too quick for him.
Well, overall, though, you know, winning one of the stakes makes for a good weekend. That said, Graham, it was a bit of a, let's call it what it was, kind of a tortured and you know, angst-ridden afternoon Saturday.
Yeah, it was tough. I mean, look, I didn't see the incident. I heard the groans, and I knew what had probably happened. And you know, I think we put incredible pressure on ourselves to try and get through these weekends without having an incident. And I'm afraid ultimately you cannot completely avoid them. It's just tragic when it happens on a big day like Saturday.
Part of what I wanted you to address is, of course, the start today of the implementation of the HIWU portion and the anti-doping medication control panel. You know, Graham, you've had an interesting journey, let's say, on topics like Lasix and. You know, medication in general. You've also experienced, you know, being caught up in a, you know, what was a, you know, a challenging scenario that you fought. Talk a little bit about your expectations and what you think stakeholders and players and people who were concerned for the game's future, how they should view today and things going forward.
Look, I think we have to hope that today is the beginning of a new era. I firmly believe the status quo doesn't work. I firmly believe HISA has to work. Otherwise, I think we could all be in trouble. And I get frustrated at the negativity towards it. You know, I'm sure you saw my communication with Chuck on Twitter. I know you're a Twitter guy. And I believe in most of what Chuck says on Twitter. He's a way smarter guy than I am on a lot of this horse racing stuff, but I just don't get the constant knocking of it. We have to give it a chance. And, you know, I pointed out that, you know, everybody made fun of the whip rules and everything. We barely hear mention about the whip rules anymore, and it needed to be done. It was embarrassing. It was awful to watch horses being hit as much as they were being hit with no regulations. Everybody was horrified when Lasix was going to be taken away on these big stake race days. I don't remember hearing anything about it on Saturday. I don't, you know, last Breeders' Cup, I don't remember it being mentioned. You know, we all throw our arms up in despair that we have these new rules. And I think we can all get through it. And I think we just have to hope it works. And, you know, I can't predict how HISA is going to work or how HIWU is going to work. But I will tell you that I'm on it. Full disclosure, I mean, I'm on an advisory board for HISA, for the horseman's group, and Lisa is an extremely reasonable person, Lisa Lazarus, and I think she's absolutely tried to do the very best she can in what's an incredibly difficult situation on a sport that's never had proper national guidelines. We need national guidelines. We need help. We need to deal with these difficult situations better than we do. And we've got to try and do everything we can to avoid them happening. We will never, ever be able to prevent horses from getting hurt. In any sport, people get hurt. It's just with horses, it's a lot more difficult to manage a horse that's injured. But we've got to take every precaution we can to try and avoid it from happening. And I only hope with HISA and with the new regulations from HIWU, I just hope this is going to help because we need it. We need it badly.
And, you know, like any, I guess, like any new set of standards and parameters, I mean, we try to include this as part of the reaction to what happened at Derby. And, you know, horses being scrutinized and you know, the least what might have passed vet inspection previously in prior years won't right now and won't going forward, it seems. And everybody has to, I guess, just understand that and deal with it. And that includes, you know, those of us that bet. Like what happened to Shug's horse, talk of the nation, that, you know, it had no apparent reason to be scratched at the gate, but was out of the proverbial abundance of caution. So I think when you say, you know, allowing things to, you know, to work and to, you know, let it find its sea legs, and undoubtedly there's going to be you know, challenges, and there's going to be things that come up that, you know, will be irksome to everybody involved. But it's better, you know, as a collective, I suppose, if everybody's on the same page, ultimately, that's the best path forward.
Look, we need integrity and we need transparency. I mean, it's incredibly difficult for us as trainers now to know where we are on many of these situations. You know, still today, each state we go to has different levels of judging a horse's soundness, whether it's before the race or after the race with a claimed horse. I mean, HISA really wants to try and iron this stuff out. They really want to get everybody on the same page. But the vets in the morning, the state vets, are under incredible pressure as to whether to pass some of these horses. It's not straightforward. We also have an extreme shortage of vets that want this job because it is such a difficult job.
Yep.
So, I mean, these are all things that HISA is really aware of. I think we have to give them a chance to try and figure this out so we can do this better. And I don't know that they can. I'm just prepared to be on board and hope that it will. I could be tripped up by the system just as well as anyone else can, but I want to believe that this is what's going to help our sport. And if I'm wrong, I don't know where we are. I don't know where we're going because we could be in trouble. So we need to hope that this works. And I don't get the fighting and bickering against it. I think we're at a point where we need to turn a corner here. And if this is what's going to make it work, if this is what's going to help us, we've got to go along with it. As trainers, as horsemen, as people that have such a passion for the sport, we need things to go well with HISA.
Well framed. Graham, I want to send everybody off with a horse that is coming up, and coming up is Delaware Park, their season, and looks like you'll be sending horses there regularly. And I'm going to ask you about just one because she's a sister of a personal favorite, and Alex Campbell's homebred, Heavenly Appointed, a point of entry that's a half to Karlovy Vary, making the debut at Delaware.
Yeah, I like this filly. I mean, I've had her entered everywhere. I think I've had her in New York, Churchill. I just haven't been able to get her in. So as long as we're on the grass on Wednesday and she's doing okay, she will run, and I'm excited to see her run. She's shown some promise in the morning.
Well, my sister was a favorite, and we're looking forward to seeing what this one offers. You got quite a few maidens you're introducing this week, but that's the one we'll leave with. Graham, congratulations on Nagarok. Obviously a big summer season ahead, and we'll see you soon. We'll talk soon.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Happy, healthy, many more birthday-wise.
Thank you, Steve.
Be sure to send Graham birthday greetings today on Twitter. He's not on Facebook, but you can get him on Twitter. All right, let's press forward, and Nick Luck will join us next before we take the first break. Probably just one break this morning with lots yet ahead. Nick Luck, Dan Blacker, and Johnny V coming up in the next, let's say, 45 minutes or so, hour. Then later, Steve Crist and Rich Migliori. Nick Luck, I saw Nick being utilized in every possible capacity. They seem to think, I think at NBC, that it's fun to put Nick in in every kind of unusual circumstance. They love sending him out to Nick Luck joining us. Nick, I was saying as I was reaching you, How the network loves to put you in that infield every Preakness.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I don't think I've ever had a day where I've had to pivot tonally so sharply so many times. I'm very happy to do whatever I'm asked, and obviously we know that going racing tends to involve a whole array of emotional experiences, and I think Saturday in a sometimes wonderful and sometimes terrible way epitomized that, really. So yeah.
Essentially, I mean, not that I don't reach out to you after big days of any kind, and you know, to preview a lot of international stands. This conversation certainly motivated by Saturday's events and the unique challenge that they presented from a reporting standpoint. You know, you've been so good and sensitive about you know, some of the social license conversations. You and I spoke after Grand National and when, you know, particularly difficult year. We've talked, you know, after Breeders' Cup at Santa Anita with Mongolian. Nick, express at a gut level, you know, the way you reacted and what you suggest the public digest from everything that happened Saturday.
Well, sadly, Steve, you and I have both been on the racetrack on high-profile occasions when there have been fatalities, and Saturday's certainly wasn't the first, and it certainly wasn't the first of a high profile. But so many layers of this story resonated, perhaps more than otherwise they would do. We know all the reasons why. I can certainly say with some confidence that I've never known the whole feel of an event fall and fall silent for quite such a sustained period after such a fatality. And I think there is clearly always sadness when there's an injury to horse. And often to rider, but it's more than that. It's a recognition that the sport is at such a crossroads, is under so much and understandably so, and is as fearful for its own future as it is regretful at the events that occasionally occur. You know, and I think you got that feeling very strongly from the crowd in those moments after having a meltdown died, and yeah, it was reinforced by the it wasn't just sadness for Bob Baffert and Jill Baffert and their team. It was a sense of real shell shock as well, I think.
And obviously the, you know, the Baffert part of this equation, it weighs heavily. I made the suggestion at the start of the show that the reaction to his Preakness win still would have been vitriolic, you know, but with the, you know, with the prequel, it just magnifies all of this, because he's already a lightning rod.
There are people who have expressed their views on this situation far more eloquently than I will. I mean, you Facebooked this, or you copied it to your Facebook page, Steve. Tim Layden's essay for NBC Sports. Yeah. I'm not just saying that because Tim's a colleague and a friend, but I thought that, you know, and he had some strong words in the aftermath of the original Medina Spirit case, and yeah, he talked a lot about the processes that a lot of people have been through examining their own souls and their own consciences about the sport since then. But I thought that his piece was brilliant, really, on Saturday in the aftermath, because it was fair and it was balanced, and it wasn't, it was trying to keep... Clearly, you can't take the emotion out of it, because people have been put through the emotional ringer all the time. But what he was trying to do was to keep a sense of a proportionality in terms of judgment on the situation, to try not to conflate an equine injury with necessarily everything that had gone before in the heat of the moment. and to realize that we were still going through a process. And you can't simply, you know, judge the entire sport based on, you know, based on one day. And I think it's a brilliant piece that he's written. It's very well balanced, very fair. Jay Pridman, good friend of both of ours, he was on my podcast this morning. He said that it's completely in tandem with the culture wars of today, that people will not get out of their entrenched positions on issues like medication use and equine fatality. They will not get out of entrenched positions and, you know, Bob Baffert and the way people perceive him, yeah, that is a perfect example of it. People are either, you know, can't have a bar of him, or they can't have a bar of the people that can't have a bar of him. Do you see what I mean? There's no sense of proportionality. There's no sense of rationale. There's no sense of being able to take a rounded view. There's no sense of wanting to have an educated, yeah, holistic conversation about use of medication. It's either you're on one extreme or the other. Rather like everything. Rather like the way we talk about politics now, the way we talk about bringing up our children now, the way we talk about culture now. Yeah, everything has to be polarized to such an extent. Unfortunately, horse racing has become, and it's the same in the UK as it is in the US, and particularly this year this has intensified here. What you and I spoke about after the Grand National, and with the Animal Rising protesters and the Stand Up for Racing campaign, we are experiencing something very similar, and it's a great fear that the sport just becomes another conduit through which the culture wars can be played out. And unfortunately for us as a sport, while I understand how that happens, it's not a way of, and I say this recognizing the irony that I say this on the day that ISA actually comes into force in totality and officially, but it's not going to do our sport any good, because it's not going to make us move forward productively, I don't think.
Well, exactly, and at the same time, I mean, we can try to have internal discussion, and, you know, try to gain, gain. I don't know if a quorum or you know, try to have everyone or as many people as possible come together, and I think that they're. In the face of external pressures,
That's why within there has to be more unity. And actually, I was talking to Dr. Benson after having a meltdown fatality the other day, and quite rightly she underlined that, you know, we're not done in terms of, you know, reinforcing veterinary checks and, you know, closer scrutiny of the animals, make sure that we know all that is good. We also know that there is probably only so far you actually can go in terms of ensuring that a horse's soundness. It's great that there's the new technology, the biometric technology to assess horses before and after and so on. What the real key is, and we discussed this and she agreed with me, is that until you have a much greater level of mutual trust between the veterinary professionals, the sort of triangle of trust, if you like, between the veterinary professionals, the people who administer the racetrack, and those responsible for looking after and curating the careers of the horses, then we're going to struggle. You need that, what I would call that triangle of trust between those three groups, that everyone believes that the other group has the best interest of the sport at heart. Because at the moment, and for understandable reasons, the racetracks, and again for understandable reasons, because there have been so many misdemeanors that have been widely reported down the last few years, and indeed crime in some cases, the racetrack, they can be suspicious of the horsemen. The horsemen are suspicious of the racetracks because they're querying their motives, and the horsemen are then resenting the vets because they think the protocols are too stringent, and the vets are then coming down harder on the horsemen because clearly they want to avoid tragic and catastrophic situations. Until those bonds and chains of trust are reestablished, then it is very difficult to push forward new measures to everybody's satisfaction.
In terms of creating a dialogue, and if not a dialogue externally, Nick, what is an adequate or appropriate policy to extol and I'm going to say fight back, because obviously just you know, presenting the very positive and encouraging statistics and the lowering of the number of fatalities per thousand starts, we're now on a par. The United States racing is now on a par with the rest of the world. Not that the rest of the world isn't under the same pressure. Australia and Europe, the most glaring examples, the Melbourne Cup and Grand National probably being the two flashpoint events. But what do we say? What do you suggest stakeholders and horse players and fans say when they're confronted? Because they are being confronted by friends, family, work associates saying, gosh, what happened at Derby? What happened to that horse Saturday? I mean, how do we confront this externally?
Well, this is the absolute question, and it's a brilliant question as well. First of all, I think as a sport, we need to remove any remaining ostriches. And there are still a few. There are still a few who will bury their heads in the sand and say, it's all part of the game. If you don't like it, get out of the game. If that attitude persists, we might not even have a decade left if that attitude persists. Luckily, that is, I don't think, the prevalent attitude anymore. You can accept the fact that every activity, whether it's a human activity or an activity that is involved with animals, you can accept the fact that there will always be some element of risk. You cannot eliminate risk, but accepting the fact that there is an element of risk is very far from saying that it's all part and parcel of the game. They're two very different things. Acknowledging the fact that you could trip over yourself walking from barn A to barn B is not the same as saying we are happy to accept the fatalities are part of the game. They are two very, very different things. And we have to be confident in the former and reject the latter. And I think we can be confident in the former. Why can we be confident in the former? Because we seek to address the latter, because we seek all the time to make our veterinary protocols better. We seek to make racetrack management better, and we seek to try and educate the breeding community to make their practices better as well, which is not talked about quite as often, but is just as important. The horses are being produced to race on these tracks. It's all very well saying the trainers are doing this, that, and the other, but they need the strongest and best and most robust raw materials to work with in what is a sport that is, properly exacting. So yes, we have to have the confidence that we are doing all these things, that have the ability to communicate that. So I think that's the first step, Steve. And I think, on a more fundamental level, we are all happy that we work in this sport. We know it to be a wonderful sport in so many respects. We know it also enriches the lives of more animals than it takes away from, if that makes any sense. It is much more to the benefit of the animal than it is to the detriment of the animal. It is also, and whilst animals will cryly be concentrated on because they don't have a voice and humans do, but it is also significantly, massively to the benefit of so many people. It's massively to the benefit of a huge workforce, of a huge immigrant workforce as well. And it's also, working with animals, whilst often demanding and often hard work, also brings an awful lot of people an awful lot of joy. You only have to go to the racetrack to see that. Yeah, we have a duty to look after our workforce well. But again, I believe that the sport is more beneficial to its workforce than it is detrimental to it. So I think that's the balance, isn't it? What the sport does has to be more beneficial to its participants and those who enjoy it and those who spectate than it does detrimental. And I still believe that we are the right side of that line. And that is something that we then have to communicate to the wider world.
100% total agreement. And, I'm not a big fan of whataboutisms, but you know, there are some things that are glaring to maybe, I don't know if they're discussion points, if they're worthwhile, and certainly the most extreme animal rights types, you know, they, for instance, pet ownership, I mean, they would abolish pet ownership if they so, had their way. You know, but for people that are pet owners, I mean, one thing that has rattled around in my head for a couple of weeks, I happen to be curious. I don't even know how this even came into my head, but I was curious how many dogs are killed being hit by cars. It's astounding. It's 100,000 a month. It's 1.2 million a year. And we lose maybe a horse a day on average. And I'm just curious, are we going to...
This is really interesting because I used to get involved in quite a few debates with people from pressure groups, animal pressure groups, animal rights organizations, animal charities. And many years ago, it was in a sense easier to frame your argument because you could say, well, you guys don't believe in pet ownership. You believe in turning all the horses out into the wild. You believe in full-scale rewilding. You don't really believe in a rural economy. You don't believe in the ethics of farming. And then you felt confident that in your argument you had 90% of the. I feel now that the cultural needle has shifted. Well, I don't feel. We know that the cultural needle has shifted. And therefore, that argument's not quite enough. I think you now have to make the case that what you're doing as a sport and as an industry is of net benefit to society. I think it's no longer good enough to say, we're not doing any harm. If you don't like it, then look away. I think we now have to make the case that we as a sport are to society and to communities and our wonderful communities as well. The race tracks themselves, and this is something I've been emphasizing to a lot of the English race tracks, that the race tracks are in, and this is particularly, I think, germane in the States, but I've been trying to introduce it, is that what do you mean to the local area? And if you're not part of your local community, why aren't you part of your local community? When you're not having a race day, can the people who live and work around you use your facility? Can they be a part of it? Can we be more imaginative, getting some of those great spaces used by a larger part of the community, both to the sort of benefit of the communities themselves and possibly to the financial benefit of the racetracks? You know, the sport's got to be reaching out rather than being increasingly isolated. Does that make sense?
Of course it does. Of course it does. Yep. I like that. Living here close to Saratoga and having spent time in places like Hot Springs, I mean, there's, and Louisville and Lexington, I mean, there obviously are prominent communities that where the culture of the horse, I suppose you should include parts of the West, the place like Oklahoma, for instance, the culture of the horse there that's strong. There's plenty of places where even those that aren't necessarily involved as horse players or fans or stakeholders in some respect, they understand the value.
They're proud of they have no interest in horse racing, they're proud of what's on their doorstep. People in Saratoga, even if they don't in the local area, they would be proud of that, I'm sure, as an institution. Similarly, if you live in central Kentucky, for Keeneland and as you say in Churchill Downs, where we've seen so many great racetracks close. I mean, Arlington Park is mourned by the horse racing community that that lived and worked there for such a long time, and it was such a beautiful track. Privileged to work there several times. But what was its relevance to the local area at the time that racing was, you know, became no longer relevant?
Well, and some of that, and this has been discussed too, some of that has also been a geographic and a real estate equation where, you know, where racetracks were built out away from a you know, within reach of a municipality and even a population center, when they were built originally in those spots, it was remote, and you know, communities grew out to them, and the property exceeds the value, you know, as commercial development venue ahead of its value. You know, conducting racing. So, you know, part of that is the way in which, you know, business ebb and flow and real estate. But you know, it doesn't necessarily make racing in those jurisdictions, you know, disinteresting or you know, not something that community necessarily wants to, you know, to have as part of its leisure activity.
Yeah, I mean, successful sporting venues are an integral part of the community. There's just no doubt about that. Anyway, I feel, well, I probably digress a little bit, but I think it all broadly ties into the same theme.
Agreed. Now, Nick, I hate that I will have to rely on you for this kind of a conversation, but you're always you know, so eloquent about it, and you've got, you know, you've got a good finger on the pulse too, because of seeing both, you know, both an international perspective and the game here. So I appreciate it immensely.
Oh, listen, it's a pleasure. You know, we care very deeply about this sport. Yeah, we try and look at things in a fair and balanced way. You know, there's so many people who care and do have the sport's best interests at heart, but I think you've always got to look at things with a sense of proportionality. If you head and veer towards the extremes and, you know, mirror the way that dialogue is in the wider world, then I think we're going to be in trouble.
Well, we've got a lot to look forward to, and we'll I suppose we won't talk until ahead of Royal Ascot. Yes.
Look forward to it.
All right, Nick. Thank you, and. How much conversation of this should we have? Maybe I haven't seen your roster for today's show and for your own conversations.
I didn't get much on the plane last night, in all honesty. So I'm a bit jet lagged, and I didn't get a lot of sleep the night before, actually, after the Preakness. I'm now driving up to Doncaster, which is about 3.5 hours from my house, to host the Thoroughbred Breeders Awards evening, having got in this morning at about 9:30 and done my podcast. So if the words aren't coming out quite as fluently as you might have wanted, I apologize. But at least you're throwing nice kind of, you know, gentle half volleys at me. And, you know, the subject matter is, you know, not that complex. So, you know, for that, I'm... I'm very grateful, Steve.
Well, are you addressing it on your show?
Jay and I were having a chat this morning. Last night, and I published this morning. So, if you want to hear a much more eloquent summation of proceedings than mine, you can do that on Nick Luck Daily, available on all good podcasts. I can't even say it. All good podcast platforms.
Well, and I saw that you had Tom Ryan as well. I just pulled up this morning's show. Very good. We'll talk to Jay as well. Nick, thanks so much. Safe travels. We'll be looking at the results of tonight's awards later on this evening.
Oh, all right, Steve. Thanks so much.
Nick Luck, everybody, and invaluable, always. Always. He had Jay on this morning and Tom Ryan as well. We're going to have Johnny B in the next half hour. Dan Blacker next. Dan first and then Johnny. Steve Crist at the top of hour three. Richmond Leori as well. First post-Preakness weekend conversations. Getting going. We've got plenty more, too. We've got to get to, obviously not today, but next couple of days. John White tomorrow and Andy Serling, and then I'm sure quite a few more. We've got to talk about Maple Leaf Mel. Bill Parcells has got his latest nice horse and the Miss Preakness win. Jeremiah Engelhart with Joelle. Haven't mentioned that performance yet. Train to Artemis for Kelly Breen and Paco. Interstate Daydream and more. Back after this. Dan Blacker, Straight No Chaser.
It's At The Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio. Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Ponds family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and curly stands, the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to know a secret? The Massachusetts Breeding Program pays huge bonuses for finishing first, second, or third at any racetrack in the country. You didn't know that, did you? Massbreds get paid up to an additional 25% of their purse earnings for the owner, and breeder, and stallion owner, and developer. It's the best kept secret in racing, till now. Tell all your friends, and to learn more, visit massbreds.com.